Good morning, everyone. I'll be here speaking on the genetics of disordered gambling this morning. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to come here and give this talk, and I appreciate people being interested. So as I do all of these days, I have a listing of disclosures with respect to relationships with pharmaceutical, gambling, and legal entities. And with that out of the way, I can talk about what we're here to discuss. And this is an overview of the discussion. So I'll be talking about the genetics of gambling disorder, starting with a focus on twin studies, and then moving into molecular genetics and touching a bit upon the neurobiology of gambling disorder in order to put the molecular genetic work into context. I'll then also talk about how allelic variation, genetic variations, link to behavioral and brain responses. And in this context, we'll not only be talking about diagnostic considerations, but also transdiagnostic considerations, as there have been people who have proposed that these may link more closely to biological entities, including genetic factors. And then talk about where we are and where we might go in the future. So with respect to considering the etiology of gambling disorder, there are data to suggest that there are both important genetic and environmental contributions. Gambling disorder tends to aggregate within families, and this aggregation might reflect either genetic or environmental contributions or both. And twin studies offer the opportunity to try to estimate the degree to which genetic or environmental factors may contribute to specific conditions, as well as their co-occurrence with other conditions. So classic twin studies, although not all twin studies, assume that there's the raising of the twins within a shared environment. And there are some assumptions that go into the modeling of data from classic twin studies. One of these is the equal environment assumption. And this tends to lead to a slight overestimation of the genetic contributions to the disorder. And the way that the data tend to be modeled is that if one knows the identity of twins with respect to either being identical or homozygous twins versus fraternal or heterozygous twins, one can estimate that the homozygous twins would have 100% shared genetic content and the heterozygous twins approximately 50%. And then one can model the data to estimate the genetic, shared environmental, and the unique environmental contributions with this last factor, the E factor, also including an error estimation. And with respect to large twin populations, there have been several that have been studied fairly extensively. Two that have been studied include the Vietnam era twin registry study that Ming Shuang and Seth Eisen put together going back into the late 1980s. But there were several waves of data collection into the 2000 using this data set. And this is an all-male twin data set that is comprised of over 7,000 male twins from the United States. And then there's a more recent Australian study that Wendy Slutsky and others have been collecting data on, somewhat smaller, but still in the quadruple digit number. And this this sample has some benefits over, or at least some differences from the Vietnam era twin data set, as it's comprised of both men and women, and there are some molecular genetic measures that are included within that sample. So I'll talk first about one of the studies that we conducted in conjunction with Seth Eisen and colleagues, looking at the Vietnam era twin sample. And we were interested in the degree to which there were shared environmental or genetic factors that contributed to pathological gambling and major depression. So first, we sought to understand whether there was a relationship between the two disorders. And if one looks at the bottom of the slide, the unadjusted odds ratio for major depression in association with pathological gambling was about 4. So there was a 4-fold increased odds between the two disorders. And that odds ratio stayed about the same when adjusting for sociodemographic factors, but it dropped to about 2, which was still statistically significant when we considered contributions or relationships with other psychiatric disorders, and in particular, alcohol abuse dependence, drug abuse dependence, antisocial personality disorder, and generalized anxiety disorder also had increased odds in a model that considered all of these psychiatric conditions and the sociodemographic factors. Now, the next few slides are going to follow this general format. And in this case, we would estimate the genetic, the shared environmental, and the unique environmental factors contributing to each disorder, pathological gambling and major depression, as well as the degree to which there were genetic and environmental contributions to the co-occurrence. So along the bottom, one can see the genetic and environmental contributions in each domain for each disorder. So about 2/3 of the variance for pathological gambling was genetics in nature, and about 1/3 was environmental, the unique environmental factor. For major depression, it was about 40% genetic in nature and about 60% environmental in nature. But on the far right, one can see that the overlap, the co-occurrence, the shared features were largely, in the best fitting model, were solely genetic in nature. So it suggests that there is a large genetic contribution to the co-occurrence of pathological gambling and major disorder, and that perhaps some of the genetic factors that lead to major depression may also lead to pathological gambling. And it suggests that we might consider this when we think about the potential genetic factors contributing to pathological gambling. So the Vietnam-era twin registry study included assessments of a broad range of psychiatric disorders, so we were also interested in looking at the co-occurrence with other psychiatric disorders. So when we looked at generalized anxiety disorder, we found a somewhat similar pattern in that there were both genetic and unique environmental contributions to each disorder, and that the overlap was predominantly genetic in nature. Best fitting model suggested solely genetic in nature. However, that wasn't the case with all anxiety disorders. So for example, between pathological gambling and panic disorder, although for panic disorder, the genetic and environmental contributions were of the same, relatively same magnitude as they were for generalized anxiety disorder, the overlap between pathological gambling and panic disorder included both shared genetic and shared environmental contributions. So this suggests that for specific anxiety disorders, the etiologies of the co-occurrence with pathological gambling may be different. And perhaps for panic disorder, those factors might be more amenable to targeting environmental factors with respect to interventions, both prevention and treatment approaches. With alcohol dependence, the pattern was largely similar to that for panic disorder, where there were both shared genetic, shared environmental contributions, and the overlap between pathological gambling and alcohol dependence included both shared genetic and environmental factors. As there's been debate about how best to threshold pathological gambling, Wendy Slutsky and colleagues who performed this study also looked at sub-threshold levels of pathological gambling. So they looked at problem pathological gambling using a relatively lax threshold. And the next slide will show that. So I'll ask people to focus on the row that says PG and looking at the A squared and E squared factors of 0.64 and 0.36, that goes down to 0.49 and 0.51 respectively, suggesting that with less severe patterns of pathological gambling or gambling problems, there is a greater environmental contribution possibly to the condition or behavior. But if one looks at the pattern of contributions to the co-occurrence, one again sees that there are both shared genetic and shared environmental features to the co-occurrence between problem pathological gambling and alcohol dependence. This pattern also seems to hold between problem pathological gambling and nicotine dependence, where there are both shared genetic and environmental contributions to the co-occurrence, as well as to cannabis abuse and dependence, with both shared and genetic and shared environmental contributions to the co-occurrence. However, if one looks at more illicit or harder drugs, for example, stimulant abuse and dependence, here the overlap tends to be predominantly genetic in nature. One area of controversy I would propose is the relationship between pathological gambling and obsessive compulsive disorder, or pathological gambling and compulsivity. So while problem pathological gambling typically co-occur frequently with multiple forms of psychopathology, population-based studies do not support an increased odds between problem pathological gambling and obsessive compulsive disorder. So Renee Cunningham-Williams and Linda Kotler and colleagues looked at the ECA data from St. Louis and found an odds ratio of 0.6 between OCD and problem pathological gambling, in contrast to the elevated odds that were seen for multiple other psychiatric disorders. However, people have proposed that transdiagnostic features relating to compulsivity may be relevant to addictive disorders, including pathological gambling. So in data from the Vietnam-era twin registry cohort in a follow-up wave, data on obsessive-compulsive features were collected. And we performed a latent class analysis and identified four classes of obsessive-compulsive groups, four classes, that differed both qualitatively and quantitatively. And I'll show what those classes involved. So there were four classes. Class one was a low obsessive compulsive group. Class four, a high obsessive compulsive group. So these differed quantitatively. And qualitatively, two classes were identified, one that scored particularly high with respect to endorsement of rituals and symmetry, and a third, class three, another group that scored high on germ and contamination types of features. And when we looked at the odds of problem pathological gambling using differing criteria thresholding, if using a lax threshold, we found significant relationships with all of the higher OC classes as compared to the low OC class. And then we also found in the 4+, so using the current thresholding for gambling disorder, we again found elevated odds for class two, so the ritual symmetry class versus the low OC class, and then for the high OC class versus the low OC class. The germs contamination class showed a trend, but not statistically significant relationship. Then given that these were twin data, we could also model the data to estimate the genetic and environmental contributions. And like with some of the other conditions, like major depression and stimulant abuse and dependence, we found that the overlap was predominantly genetic in nature. So to summarize the Vietnam-era twin registry data, It seems that there are greater genetic contributions to more stringently thresholded levels of problem pathological gambling. So the more severe the gambling problem, the greater the genetic contribution. And that the co-occurrences between problem pathological gambling and major depression, generalized anxiety disorder, stimulant abuse and dependence, and obsessive compulsive classes appear linked to predominantly genetic factors, which suggests that when we think about interventions, we may want to consider genetic differences, particularly in these cases. Co-occurrence between problem pathological gambling and panic disorder, alcohol dependence, nicotine dependence, and cannabis use disorder appear linked to both environmental and genetic factors. So one might think that interventions targeting both, and you know, more so environmental compared to the other disorders, might be worth considering. So with respect to the Australian twin data set, Wendy Slutsky and colleagues have been doing, I think, some very elegant and important work using these data. They've extended some of the prior findings from the Vietnam era twin registry cohort and have shown that there seem to be similar genetic and environmental contributions to problem pathological gambling in men and women. But there do seem to be differences between men and women, where the genetic contributions to the gambling age of onset is greater in men than in women, and that shared environmental factors seem to be more strongly linked to gambling behaviors, including gambling age of onset, in women. So it suggests that perhaps these environmental factors may be particularly relevant to the development of gambling problems in women and perhaps interventions for women. Genetic factors linked to temperament and oppositional defiant disorder behavior appear to be to link gambling age of onset and gambling problems, and also local area disadvantage, so poverty amongst other disadvantageous features of the environment appear to increase the likelihood of the genetic expression of the propensity to gamble and to develop gambling problems. So it suggests that even if one has a certain genetic propensity, that environmental factors are important to consider and to target in interventions in order to help prevent the development of gambling problems. So I'm going to shift gears a bit and talk about molecular genetics. And I think in talking about molecular genetics, it's important to have some background on the neurobiology of pathological gambling or gambling disorder. And a number of neurotransmitter systems have been linked to gambling disorder, and they've been proposed to have specific roles in gambling disorder, although these should be taken with a grain of salt, particularly as we go further into the talk and discuss interactions between neurotransmitter systems. So with respect to molecular genetic studies of pathological gambling, these have been conducted over the past 20 years or so. And usually people like, in the genetics field, like to have particularly large samples on the order of 5,000 or more individuals so that one can appropriately stratify for race or race related factors as well as other considerations. So most of the studies that have been performed to date involving pathological gambling have been relatively small, and sometimes the samples have not been as well characterized as in some other disorders with respect to considering a broad range of co-occurring disorders, for example. And there's been one GWAS genome-wide association study for gambling disorder published to date, and there were no findings that survived a genome-wide significance thresholding. There was suggestive significance for some non-exonic, non-coding regions close to several genes, including a metallothionein gene and a very low-density lipoprotein receptor gene. So these are not the genes that one a priori may have predicted to be most closely linked to gambling disorder or pathological gambling. But I think these sorts of studies that are data-driven are important in terms of identifying new potential targets. So I'm going to shift gears a bit and talk about some genes that have commonly occurring allelic variations, and that these variations, these variants, have known functional correlates. So one of these is in the catechol-O-methyltransferase gene, where there is a allelic polymorphism at the 158 allele, the Val-Met 158 allele. And this difference is associated with functional differences in enzymatic activity of this enzyme that breaks down dopamine, for example. So people may have heard of this as the warrior-warrior gene that was termed by Dan Stein about a decade ago. But the individuals who have the Val variant are more warrior-like, and the Met allele is associated with anxiety disorders as well as better cognitive functioning. And so termed the warrior variant. So John Grant and colleagues were testing a medication that is a COMT inhibitor, tolcapone, and thought that allelic variation at the Val-Met 158 location would link importantly to treatment outcome and to brain function. And in this small study, the data that he and his colleagues collected were in line with this, where the improvement in PGY box was most robust in the Val-Val group and less robust in the Met-Met group. And doing a planning task, a tower-related planning task, he saw in this relatively small group, so it's an N of 12 here for an fMRI study, he found pre-treatment to post-treatment differences in the activation of a right frontal parietal network, so a brain network implicated in attention and cognitive functioning. He found a change that brought the individuals with gambling disorder closer to the healthy volunteer group at baseline following treatment with tolcapone. So promising, but I think warrants further investigation. So I'm going to change gears again a bit and talk about alcohol use in gambling. Some of you may have seen this slide before. It's one that I frequently use. And this is a precursor to scratch-off lottery tickets where people would pay 10 cents and push out one of these tabs, and on the back would be a number where one would receive either one beer or two beers for the winning numbers. And this, I think, highlights a complex social relationship between alcohol use and gambling. As we heard earlier, there's also a genetic and environmental link between the two. And the genetic link made us think that some of the medications for that are approved for alcohol dependence might be helpful for people with gambling disorder, because there are no medications that have FDA approval or for the indication of pathological gambling or gambling disorder, as well as for other of the what were in DSM-IV, the impulse control disorders. And of the medications that are indicated for alcohol dependence, we thought naltrexone might be particularly relevant to examine further, particularly as these were hypothesized to work through modulation of the dopamine neurotransmission pathway in the mesolimbic or mesoaccumbens pathway, going from the ventral tegmental area to the nucleus accumbens. And there have been multiple randomized clinical trials, four that have found naltrexone or nalmefene, which is another opioid receptor antagonist, to be superior to placebo to varying degrees in the treatment of pathological gambling, although the impact of the efficacy has been debated. These are data from one of the randomized clinical trials. So this is a multi-site trial in which we and others were involved. It assessed approximately 200 individuals with pathological gambling. And one can see that in terms of the percent of responders, the nalmefene group, nalmefene was superior to placebo with respect to improved treatment outcome, in this case on the clinical global improvement scale score. About close to 60% of individuals receiving 25 milligrams of nalmefene, which is roughly equivalent to 50 milligrams per day of naltrexone, were much improved or very much improved as compared to about 35% of individuals receiving placebo. So while nalmefene was superior to placebo, it didn't work for everyone. And we thought that we were curious about what some of the clinical factors might be that link to better or to worse treatment outcome. So John Grant, myself, and others looked at some of these data from two of the studies. And when we looked at the factors that were most strongly associated with treatment outcome, the most statistically robust factor was a family history of alcoholism. So it suggests, consistent with the genetics data, that there may be some link, perhaps at a genetic level, that associates pathological gambling with alcoholism or risk for alcoholism that naltrexone might particularly target. Also, amongst the subjects receiving higher doses of the active drug, gambling urges were associated with treatment outcomes. So people who had stronger gambling urges at treatment outcome, at treatment onset were more likely to respond to the active drug. We didn't see these patterns amongst individuals receiving placebo, where the most statistically robust association was with age, where older individuals were less likely to be placebo responders. So in terms of thinking about factors, genetic factors that have been linked to treatment outcome with respect to opioid antagonist treatment, there's been work in this area done over the past 10 to 15 years, including out of the University of Pennsylvania group in conjunction with Yale, as well as other groups. But specifically, variants in the gene coding for the opioid, the mu opioid receptor, have been linked to treatment outcome. There is an A118G variant where individuals who were G carriers had lower rates of relapse and longer times to return to heavy drinking during naltrexone treatment. However, the question remains as to whether this might apply to gambling disorder. And data out of Scandinavia that were published earlier this year, they performed a randomized clinical trial of as-needed naltrexone. And this was not found to be superior to placebo. But when they looked at the genetic information, the genotyping of the mu opioid receptor gene, they found a relationship with the AA variant being related to better, more improvement in emotional well-being in the trial. So these findings differ from those in the alcohol use field and raises questions about some of the differences that may exist with respect to genetic factors linked to treatment outcome. I think it's also worthwhile to note that people have been looking at this from the preclinical perspective, that Catherine Winstanley and colleagues, amongst other groups, have developed rodent gambling task models. And one group has looked at the effects of naltrexone in a rat gambling task and found that naltrexone was more effective in improving task performance in the rats who at baseline made more disadvantageous selections or made poorer decisions, quote unquote, on the task. However, in mice, there seemed to be different findings where naltrexone did not affect performance on the mouse gambling task, but did reduce waiting forms of impulsivity, so a response form of impulsivity. I think it will be important to carefully consider how these relate to the human condition, but given the experimentation that can be done in rodents, I think this is a promising line of investigation to continue to follow. And then a study by Mick and colleagues, including Henrietta Bowden-Jones and Luke Clark, recently reported an investigation of the opioid receptor availability, as well as the release of endogenous opioids following amphetamine dosing. And what they found was that there was no baseline difference in mu opioid receptor availability. However, following the administration of amphetamine, the individuals with gambling disorders compared to those without showed a blunted release of endogenous opioids. And these findings suggest that there are complex interactions between these neurotransmitter systems that might be clinically relevant. So their findings are shown here with respect to seeing differences in release in frontal lobe, insula, anterior cingulate, as well as in the striatum, although it doesn't look like the nucleus accumbens reach statistical significance, as well as in the cerebellum. Now, the interactions of neurotransmitters and the relationships between specific neurotransmitters with respect to dopamine, I think, have also been a focus of study. People have looked at the dopamine D2 receptor systems. So just as a means of background, D2, D3, and D4 are structurally similar, and D2 and D3 tend to be expressed to varying degrees in the same structure. So trying to disentangle D2 and D3 has been, I think, challenging. And from a clinical perspective, drugs that antagonize the D2-like receptors have not shown clinical efficacy in the treatments of addiction, whereas some drugs that activate D2, D3 receptors, particularly D3 receptors, have been proposed to link importantly to the onset of gambling behaviors in individuals with Parkinson's disease, as well as in individuals with restless leg syndrome. And preclinical data with respect to cued decision making also seem to link importantly to this story. More recently, people have used newer radioligands that have different specificities for D2 versus D3. So traditionally, raclopride has been used, but drugs like PHNO, which are more highly selective for the D3 receptor, are showing, I think, novel insight into the D3 system and how it may be related to addictive disorders. So findings have come from Isabelle Boyeux and the Toronto group, as well as from our group, and I'll describe some of those. So in cocaine use disorder and in stimulant dependence, both the Toronto and the Yale groups have found in independent samples that cocaine use disorder is associated with elevated PHNO availability in the substantia nigra. And this is thought to be predominantly D3 in nature. Some of those data seem to resonate with those from gambling disorder, where there's a positive correlation between binding of PH&O in the substantia nigra and SOG scores. And there's also an inverse relationship in individuals with gambling disorder between striatal dopamine release following amphetamine challenge and SOG scores. So these findings tend to resonate with those in the cocaine field and also resonate with those from Mick and colleagues. So one can also try to estimate the fractions of D2 and D3 in specific brain regions by applying radioligands and then antagonists to see the extent to which they're blocked. And this shows a number of brain regions, dorsal putamen, dorsal caudate, ventral striatum, globus pallidus, ventral pallidum, substantia nigra, hypothalamus, and shows the estimated proportions of D2 and D3 in these structures. So some of our data have looked at the differences using both region of interest and general linear model approaches in individuals with cocaine dependence and those without. And some of these findings appear to link to both the D2 findings in cocaine dependence as well as the D3. So we observe in the substantia nigra that the individuals with cocaine dependence as compared to those without have greater availability, greater binding of the PH&O ligand. And in the dorsal putamen, there's a decreased availability in the individuals with cocaine dependence. So it suggests that there may be different patterns in these two regions where the dorsal putamen is, as we saw on the prior slide, more D2 enriched and the substantia nigra is more D3 enriched. So we also wanted to understand whether we might be able to look at the networks that are associated with D2 and D3. So we used an approach called independent component analysis. And this is a data-driven computational technique that can be used to identify independent sources of a measurement or signal. It attempts to unmix these signals and identify true sources. So in a general term, one might think about this as hearing a tape of a cocktail conversation and trying to pull out the individual conversations that are occurring. So this approach has been applied to more widely to EEG and MRI data. And in functional MRI, it reliably identifies brain networks like the default mode network, as well as attentional networks like the right frontal parietal or left frontal parietal networks. And we thought that we would apply this approach to PET using the PH&O data. And so I won't go into the details of the methods, but there were three networks that were identified, a striatopalatal, palatal nigral, and a mesoaccumbens set of D2, D3 regions. Of those three, the striatopalatal seem to correlate with D2 receptor availability in the structures. It showed a relatively decreased engagement in the cocaine-dependent individuals as compared to the healthy control individuals. And we saw an inverse correlation with years of cocaine use between that network and within the cocaine-dependent subjects. The palatal nigral showed a different pattern. It correlated strongly with the D3 regions and was elevated in the cocaine-dependent individuals and correlated positively with years of cocaine use. So I think these data may provide insight into why it's been challenging to develop pharmacotherapies targeting dopamine D2-like receptors in individuals with cocaine dependence and perhaps more broadly to other addictive disorders, although this warrants direct investigation. There are other targets that may be considered. One of those is the serotonin 1B receptor, which in preclinical models has been implicated in modulating dopamine transmission in the ventral striatum. And here we see a positive correlation in individuals with gambling problems between binding potential for this 5-HT1B ligand and problem gambling severity scores. And this resonates with findings in the alcohol dependence literature, where we see increased binding in the pallidum and ventral striatum in the individuals with alcohol dependence as compared to control and subjects. So I'm going to shift gears again and going to be talking now about some transdiagnostic considerations. I think that this has been a movement that a number of groups have been interested in studying and understanding, going from the research domain criteria to the Phoenix or FENEX movement, amongst others, Romer in Europe. And one transdiagnostic entity, potential endophenotype, that people have been interested in understanding with respect to addiction is impulsivity. Jerry Muller and colleagues describe this as a predisposition toward rapid unplanned reactions to internal or external stimuli, with diminished regard to the negative consequences of these reactions to the impulse of individual or to others. And if one thinks about this as a working definition, one can see that it's multifaceted. It seems to link to some core elements of addiction, including continued engagement in a behavior despite adverse consequences. It appears relevant to a broad range of psychiatric groups, individuals with impulse control disorders, substance use disorder, bipolar disorder, amongst others. And when people have done principal component analysis or other sorts of approaches to try to identify specific factors related to impulsivity, two or more factors are typically identified, two that seem dissociable but both relevant to addictive disorders involve choice impulsivity that can be assessed through behavioral tasks, like intertemporal choice tasks, and then response impulsivity, which can be further fractionated, but tends to include disinhibition or attentional tasks like go, no go, or Stroop. Compulsivity is another potential endophenotype that people have become interested in understanding and believe may be linked in important ways to addiction, with the idea that addictions may move from being more impulsive to compulsive over time. And compulsivity has been defined by Naomi Feinberg and others as a tendency to perform repetitive and functionally impairing overt or covert behaviors without apparent adaptive function, that they are performed in a habitual or stereotype fashion according to rigid rules or as a means of avoiding perceived negative consequences. So this may relate to more either habitual aspects of addiction or perhaps even to negative reinforcement motivations for engaging in addictive disorders. Compulsivity is also relevant to a range of psychiatric disorders, and there are both behavioral and self-report measures for assessing compulsivity. And when we have looked at how impulsivity might relate to treatment outcome for individuals with gambling problems, we found that both may have roles. So for example, in one study from a paroxetine trial, we found that in the whole sample that at treatment onset, problem gambling severity correlated both with measures of impulsivity as well as specific aspects of compulsivity using the Padua inventory, particularly with the impaired control over mental activities component. While both impulsivity and compulsivity decreased during treatment, the changes in problem gambling severity scores correlated with changes in impulsivity, but not with changes in compulsivity, suggesting that how people perceive their behaviors, at least with respect to impulsivity, was important with respect to better treatment outcome in the gambling domain. We found something somewhat different in a trial of memantine, an open label trial of this glutamatergic drug. We used behavioral measures targeting compulsivity, the intradimensional, extradimensional set shifting task, as well as impulsivity on the stop signal task. And these data suggested that perhaps treatment response was more linked to compulsivity, although there were some, the extent to which some of these measures might be useful in repeated measures studies could be debated. So in terms of thinking about where we might be going, I think the idea that we can collect data in multiple important domains, complex domains like brain imaging and genetics, suggests that perhaps we might be able to use advanced analytic approaches to try to identify those most salient relationships. And one approach is to use parallel independent component analysis in these multiple domains. One of the ways in which we've applied this is with understanding genotypic data and looking at relationship to impulsivity domains, and this was in a sample of a couple of thousand college students, but there were a little over 400 individuals with genotypic data. So the findings that we identified genetic clusters that linked to two of the impulsivity-related domains that were identified using this approach, this data-driven approach. And these genetic clusters involved or implicated genes that are have been involved in neurogenesis, neurotransmission, and immune system responses. So it suggests that there may be complex etiologies underlying these transdiagnostic features. And the list of important transdiagnostic domains, I think, may be relatively extensive for gambling disorder. And these can include some of the research domain criteria factors like positive valence systems and negative valence systems that are related to reward and loss related phenomenon respectively. Attention or inattention, cognitive processes, stress processing, as well as emotional regulation are all potential domains to consider. With respect to emotional regulation, we thought that there might be some specific allelic variants that warranted direct investigation in pathological gambling. So one of these, if we go back to the idea of studying allelic variations with known functional consequences, is the dopamine beta hydroxylase gene. So this gene codes for an enzyme which is involved in converting dopamine to norepinephrine, and there's a functional allelic variant that's associated with about 35 to 50% of the enzymatic activity. So TT individuals have the lowest enzymatic activity, and CC individuals have the highest, with CT individuals showing intermediate levels. And from a clinical perspective, individuals who have one or more T genes have been found to demonstrate less empathy, demonstrate lower conscientiousness, have higher neuroticism, have more novelty seeking, and greater drug use severity. So we thought that this would warrant investigation in individuals with gambling problems. So we combined brain imaging and genetics in this study. So this involved 43 individuals, 18 individuals with pathological gambling, 25 control comparison subjects, and the T carrier versus CC individuals showed a relatively similar breakdown amongst the groups. And we looked at their subjective and brain responses to emotional and motivationally laden videotapes. So these videotapes had content of sad, gambling-related and cocaine-related content. And we hypothesized and observed a main effect of DBH genotype on subjective responses to the tape, where we thought that the T carriers would show less of an emotional response to the SAD videotapes, and that was true. And then we also hypothesized that the responses would differ according to DBH genotype. And specifically, we hypothesized that there would be an effect of DBH across the conditions, and specifically a DBH by condition effect, where this would be linked more to the SAD tape responses than to the gambling and the cocaine related. So what we found here was a main effect of DBH genotype involving corticostriatal-limbic brain regions, including amygdala and ventromedial prefrontal cortex and striatum, where the CC individual showed a greater activation than did the T carriers. We also observed a DBH by condition effect involving the thalamus, striatum, insula, hippocampus, amongst other cortical brain regions. And this was specific to the SAD videotapes, as we hypothesized, where we didn't see a between group difference in the others. So it suggests that some commonly occurring allelic variants may cut across both pathological gambling and healthy control subjects with response at least to emotional responses to sadness and potentially things like empathy as well. And I think an important area that hasn't been as well studied yet in gambling disorder, but has been studied more thoroughly in other psychiatric conditions, is with respect to gene expression. So one can look at methylation patterns of genes to identify the extent to which the specific genes may be expressed. And going back to the dopamine D2 receptor gene, the DRD2, there were differences in methylation relating to whether people were in treatment or not, where the individuals who were not in treatment showed higher DRD2 methylation, and that the individuals who were abstinent showed lower DRD2 methylation. And these findings appeared to be driven by individuals who were high in impulsivity, so it suggests that there might be potentials for molecular medicine, although this remains to be studied further. I think that other areas of medicine have moved forward more rapidly with respect to understanding the molecular etiologies of conditions, for example, specific forms of cancer, as well as HIV. The fields have been advanced significantly by understanding the molecular and cellular mechanisms that underlie disease and disease progression, and now can be targeted more effectively. I think this may be challenging for psychiatric disorders, given that the etiologies may be more heterogeneous and may involve smaller contributions from a wider range of genes, as well as how environmental factors interact with these genes. But I think we should still pursue this line as we move towards more personalized medicine. And then if we think more broadly and think about other behavioral addictions, the studies are even fewer and further between. However, the TACA1 allele of DRD2, like it has been associated with gambling disorder and substance use disorders, as well as obesity, has been associated with problematic internet use, although I would caution people to link this specifically to the D2, because some studies where one looks at genome-wide studies, particularly in alcohol, some of these may be associated more closely with close-by genes like ANK1, and I think we need to do more research to better understand these etiologies and how we might translate them into better prevention and treatment strategies. So in conclusion, I think that while we've made significant progress in understanding the genetics of pathological gambling or gambling disorder, we still have significant knowledge gaps. Gene by environment studies, I think, will provide important insight into what genes are expressed under which circumstances and how this might relate to people developing gambling problems, as well as how people might recover from gambling problems. And as we understand the molecular mechanisms better, we might be able to develop more targeted and personalized treatments, although this has been particularly challenging for addictions, and we still have work to do. So I'd like to thank a whole group of people for their involvement in this research, as well as funding agencies. I'd like to thank you all for your attention. And we have time for questions. So the question was regarding the thrill of gambling and how it might differ from other substance addictions, whether there is what is known about the role for norepinephrine in gambling disorder. And I think that there is an important role for norepinephrine. And Gerhard, you could probably speak to this well. Since you've done some of the studies into norepinephrine and arousal and stress systems. I think it is an important component. I think it's also important that as we move forward, we understand the different motivations that different people might have for gambling, because there are also important negative reinforcement reasons that may differ from the positive reinforcement reasons for gambling. And these may relate differently to different neurotransmitter systems, including norepinephrine. Yes?
So my name is Dave Walker. I'm a cultist. So I came not expecting to understand very much.
That's true. Sorry about that. Well, so the question was, am I putting too much faith in twin studies, in the classic design, and where is the epigenetics? So I touched upon epigenetics near the end of the talk, and also some of the data that Wendy Slutsky and colleagues have been conducting with the Australian twin data set indicates an important role for epigenetic phenomenon, although we don't fully understand the precise aspects of those phenomenon. So the epigenetics phenomenon that I discussed were these preliminary findings relating to gene expression, and I think this is an area that has been, it's emerging right now over the past 10, 15 years, and it's being applied more widely to other psychiatric disorders than it is to genetics, and I think it will be important to understand that. With respect to the epigenetic phenomenon within the twin data sets, I think Wendy Slutsky's paper on disadvantage social status linking to the expression of a phenotype, gambling behaviors and gambling disorder, points to epigenetic phenomenon that we need to understand better. So one of the problems in the field is that there are not many large studies that have looked at gambling behaviors. In fact, gambling behaviors and gambling disorders are often omitted from large-scale populations. So that has left us with a gap in our understanding. I chose to focus on the twin studies, particularly the Vietnam-era twin registry cohort, because it's a large sample, over 7,000 individuals. It does have its limitations. I didn't expound upon them, but certainly the lack of molecular genetic and methylation expression data is one of those limitations. That being said, I think early on in the genetic studies, there was a large focus on molecular studies of candidate genes, which I think are fraught with perhaps even more limitations. So of the two, I would choose to focus more on the twin data set where there's a larger sample with an understanding of those limitations and the need to understand better the how gene-environment interactions operate. So the question is, if you're looking at an infrequent event like gambling disorder, you're going to need a larger sample in order to have sufficient power to make meaningful statements. I agree with that statement. I think that there are ways in which we can gather more information if we, for example, look at gambling behaviors along a more continuous spectrum rather than a highly stringently, arguably thresholded diagnostic level. So I do remain hopeful. I'm a clinician. I want to be hopeful. I want people to change and get better. So that may be part of my nature. But I do think we can move the field forward by thinking about this in different ways. That we can take advantage of the data that we have and think about how to design better studies to address some of the gaps that exist. Nadia. Yeah, so the question was how we think about classifying medications with respect to diagnostic versus transdiagnostic entities. And I think that this is an area of change right now in the field, and we should try to be mindful of looking at where the data are most helpful. I personally think that there's utility both to the categorical groupings as well as the transdiagnostic groupings, and I think that they will show us different things. So right now, one of the manuscripts that I think we have under review is looking at simultaneously looking at the same data set using transdiagnostic approaches as compared with categorical diagnostic approaches, looking at impulsivity and looking at brain structure in individuals with cocaine use disorder, gambling disorder, and individuals with neither. And interestingly, the impulsivity measures relate across diagnostic groups to subcortical measures, where the categorical designations, the diagnostic groups, relate to cortical differences between the groups, particularly with the cocaine-dependent group showing significant differences in frontal cortical volumes as compared to the two other groups. So I think both are going to show us important important information, important insight into the human condition. And I think some of this will be collecting the data and, you know, trying to understand how, you know, whether these link more closely to the transdiagnostic features, the treatments that we have, or whether they link more to the diagnostic categories that I think people find useful when they're entering a clinical setting. So I see people with gambling problems on Monday afternoons, and they don't come to me saying I have increased impulsivity. They come to me saying I have a gambling problem. So trying to understand it within that context, I think, is important. But I think as we move towards understanding how the brain works with respect to behavior and how our interventions may target specific aspects of specific behaviors, I think we should be open to thinking about anti-craving and anti-impulsivity medications to put it into both frameworks. Henrietta? So the question was about the potential use of naltrexone or perhaps other medications in people who may be identified as high risk for developing gambling problems. And I think that's one that is worth at least thinking about. I think all medications have potential risks associated with them. Naltrexone is one where, in addition to potential adverse effects, one needs to monitor regularly liver function tests. So there's the patient burden of getting regular blood tests. So there are a number of factors that are involved that could potentially limit the willingness of people to take the medication as well as in a preventative fashion. Usually when I'm seeing people with gambling problems, it's still a dialogue about whether or not they are willing to take the medication and take it regularly. So I think it's worth considering, but I think sometimes even just the information that one is at higher risk can change people's decisions and their behavior. Thank you. Yeah, so I think those are good questions. It's trying to think about the potential effects of the intervention on multiple domains outside of gambling. And I think that those are worth thinking about. I think it's worth collecting data if one is engaging people in such a manner and looking at these carefully. So the question was with respect to the dopamine transporter and different mechanisms of clearance or degradation of dopamine in different brain regions where the dopamine transporter may be particularly relevant to, you know, the striatal function. And yes, there are allelic variations of the dopamine transporter. So there is a variable number of tandem repeat element within the dopamine transporter, that the most frequent allelic variations in the general population are the 9 and 10 repeats, but people can have fewer or more than those, and they are associated with psychiatric conditions. It's been particularly implicated in attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And we have looked at some of our brain imaging data, and I think that there are some interesting findings with respect to the dopamine transport, the DHE SLC6A3 gene. So. So the question is regarding the extent to which any one gene is explaining a substantial portion of the heritability of gambling disorder. And as you were supposing, the data suggests that many genes are making small contributions. So it will be, I think, the approach of using large data sets and using different analytic techniques to try to identify different patterns within the data may down the road be very helpful in terms of understanding gambling problems. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, sorry. I'm kind of turned away from.
Part two is, what is your perception
Okay. So there were several questions there. One was on co-occurring conditions, including co-occurring medical conditions. And one was on medications and their role in perhaps promoting impulsive behaviors, including gambling. So with respect to co-occurring medical conditions, there are data from multiple studies suggesting that there are high, elevated co-occurrences between gambling problems and medical conditions. Some of these data come from clinic-based studies. Some of these data come from population-based studies like the NESARC. And the NESARC, I think, is particularly informative with respect to looking at the co-occurrences given the large sample size. So the concern that was raised about rare events in a sample of 43,000 individuals, one can get a better, there are more of these rare events there. Some of the limitations of the NESARC include a relatively low frequency of pathological gambling, so lifetime was 0.4% in that sample. So even with the large sample, there's a relatively small number of individuals with pathological gambling. And then the medical conditions that were assessed were, they weren't as arguably as well structured as the psychiatric assessments, but they're data from the SF-12 as well as other measures that I think are good. We have looked at some of those relationships, including looking at incident disorders, since there are data from two waves of the NESARC that are connected and allow for a study of incident disorders, so that one can at least have some insight into the temporal relationship between conditions. There has been in the media as well as in the scientific literature, there's been investigation or discussion of specific medical conditions and their links to impulse control behaviors and disorders, including pathological gambling. So probably of most note is the relationship between Parkinson's disease and gambling problems, as well as other impulse control problems in the areas of sex, eating, shopping. Probably the most definitive study done to date is the Dominion study. Dan Weintraub was the first author. It was published in 2010. It was a multi-site trial looking at over 3,000 individuals with Parkinson's disease and doing active screening and assessment of impulse control disorders. It was a cross-sectional study, so looking at causality, one should be very cautious about that in cross-sectional data. And it looks like the etiology of, or the associations with gambling problems and other impulse control problems looks multifactorial. So there were in models that took into account multiple factors, there were contributions from dopamine agonists, including pramipexole and ropinirole, as well as amantadine. There were relationships with levodopa dosing. There were also relationships with factors that are unrelated, presumably, to Parkinson's disease, including marital status, geographic location, whether one was living in the United States or Canada, that were linked to the development or the reporting of an impulse control problem in Parkinson's disease. So it suggests that these conditions have multiple factors that are associated with them, and there may be contributions from multiple domains. And in my view, it's hard to link the etiology to one specific factor. You're welcome. Good morning. I would go with both. So the question was with respect to inattention, how it relates to gambling problems, whether this should be considered within a neurodevelopmental perspective. I think all of those are true. Inattention has been linked to specific psychiatric conditions like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and the involvement of specific brain networks that are linked to attention or inattention, I think warrant further investigation as it relates to gambling behaviors across the lifespan. So I think it's an area that has been relatively understudied because attention deficit hyperactivity disorder has, in some ways like gambling disorder, been omitted from large scale studies. So we don't understand the relationship as well. We have a review, systematic review coming out. It's in press right now, looking at the relationship between gambling disorder and attention hyperactivity disorder. My pleasure. Other questions? I'll do a full scan of the room to make sure I'm not missing people. Well, I'd like to thank you all for your wonderful questions and attention.